Hello and welcome to the Sunstone Firesides Podcast. I am one of the co-hosts, Kimberly Anderson. I am joined today by my friend Wendell Hare. We are in the Sunstone Studios in Salt Lake City. And Wendell, I'm so thrilled to be doing this with you. We have done a series of interviews over the past...
About 4 years now.
4 years.
Honestly, I wasn't expecting to be on a podcast interview, but here we are.
Here we are. How would you introduce yourself to the Sunstone audience? What would you say about Wendell?
I was born of a goodly parent.
Are we starting there? Wendell 1-1.
Yeah. I mean, for me, what truly defines like where I came from or who I am, it goes back to my mother. And in general, I guess where I'm from North Carolina. I lived out here in Utah for almost 7 to 8 years now. 29 years old, have one sibling, wonderful family. How I got here has been an incredible journey. How, like, my family, my mom, and the people who have influenced my life in the early years and still to this day, even though they are 2,000 miles away.
Where are they? Where do they live? Where are you from?
My family is all back in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised there. About several generations, I think. My great great grandfather was born there, but I'm not entirely for sure. So we've been there all our lives. As of now, I think I'm the old. I have two uncles who live in Colorado Springs. Mm. So I beat them about 900 miles, being, I think, the furthest from the west from my immediate family. Mm-hmm. That live west. So, yeah.
So there's an interesting elephant in the room that's kind of dancing around. Two things that you didn't really say about yourself.
Oh, well, I am a gay or... part of the LGBTQ community, and I am African American, black, or just Afro American, or however you like to think of it. Just know that my skin color is dark.
Mm-hmm. And beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a white girl, and we did talk about this at lunch, that I undoubtedly today will screw up. And I will probably say something that's offensive. And I've given Wendell the green light to call me out and to correct me. I appreciate our friendship and our ability to do that with each other. It's been really lovely.
It's been great.
Yeah. So you're a gay black man. Tell us about your journey within Mormonism.
My journey in Mormonism. Well... It has been wonderful, but at the same time, it's been incredibly painful. Like a lot of our audience here has probably understands. I'm a convert. Was baptized when I was 17. 2 years later, I served a mission to Utah St. George, and loved Utah so much I came back and I've started my life there, lived in St. George for about 4 years, and then I moved up to Salt Lake. Now I preside in the Valley.
You preside in the Valley?
West Valley City.
Or do you reside in the Valley?
I reside in the Valley. There we go.
No, that's like the funniest little Mormon slippage of the tongue. That's really funny.
Yes. So I can honestly say that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has influenced quite a bit of my life. Mm-hmm. But I can honestly say, you know, from my non-Mormon upbringing, it's kind of helped me go through this journey as well.
Mm. Tell me about your conversion process. How was that? What was that like?
My conversion process was phenomenal. It was amazing. So I was 16 at the time when I was trying to figure out, you know, who I was. I didn't think I really had that many friends. I felt, you know, I was alone trying to figure out, like, why am I here? What What use am I here? There came a point where I was just incredibly depressed to the point where I felt like I was going to just take my life, just end it right then and there. And I actually had a really good friend. Didn't know she was Mormon. Her and her mom, basically, we were in the process of trying to find a college. So they invited me to go to a BYU college fair. I didn't know what Brigham Young University was. I didn't know any of the terminology. I didn't know what seminary was. I knew that she talked about seminary, and back east we had early morning seminary.
Oh, right.
So she had to get up super early, which I couldn't understand or fathom that anyone would want to do that. So I asked mom if I could go, and she let me go because, you know, good parents do think about their child's future, and she wanted me to go to college. I know. The whole event was, for me, kind of weird because they made us dress up in our Sunday best.
To go to seminary.
Or to go to this college fair.
Oh, okay.
And I guess I put on what I felt was the best at the time. Mom didn't really go to church except for, like, special events or anything like that. So we went, and I think the first thing that I noticed is that they offered a prayer. I'm like, okay. So I bowed my head like everyone else, and I offered up a prayer. And then, you know, the whole event came to an end, and then we were on our way back home. And, you know, I was interested. You know, BYU sounded like a really good school. Mm-hmm. So I started asking questions because they talked about seminary credits. It's like, okay, so what's seminary? And Sister Trout said, it's Bible school. It's Bible school for our church. I'm like, I didn't think you would need, like, to go to a Bible study or Bible school to go to college. Mm-hmm. So I dived more into it. I'm like, okay. And here I am thinking, oh, so they're like Presbyterian or Methodist, because there's about 1,000 churches in like a 100-mile radius of where I lived. So I asked, okay, so what church do you go, like, what church do you belong to? And she said, we belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I'm like, I've never heard of that church before. And then she just looked at me and smiled. I was like, we're Mormons. And that's when it just, wow, what did I just get myself into? I've heard quite a bit about the Mormons. A ton of my high school classmates made fun of Mormons and all that stuff. And I'm like, here, trying to unlatch my seatbelt and get out of the car because I think they're crazy. I think
you're ready to bail.
Yeah. And, you know, she smiled and she knew that I probably had those preconceived notions of Mormonism. Uh-huh. So she just said, ask away, ask any question you want. And I did. And I asked her about polygamy. I asked her about this, and this. Do you believe, like, in dancing around a fire? And I've heard some pretty crazy stuff.
What about horns on the head?
That too.
Okay.
I heard about that. I forgot about that, actually. I'm like, Lena doesn't have horns on her head.
Did you ask to look? Did you ask to see?
I patted her on the head, actually, and she did it.
Oh, my gosh.
I remember that. And then, you know, I was like, okay, well, I guess all of my questions have pretty much been debunked. And she says, you know, the only way you can know truly what it is to, you know, come. And, like, she invited me to come to seminary. I tried to get out of it. I really did. So I called I need my mom's permission first. So I called her and she just snatched the phone and told her what was going on. And my mom's like, okay, if that's what Wendell wants to do. And I'm like, shit.
And it really wasn't what you wanted to do, or was it what you wanted to do?
It was, but at the same time, I was super scared. Okay. I was scared of, like, what I was getting myself into. I've heard some crazy stuff about Mormons and Mormonism. And so I asked her, if you just give me a week so I can, you know, at least get myself acclimated to getting up at 5:30 in the morning. And I did. And then when that week passed by, I was, you know, already dressed for school, because after seminary, we go straight to school. And I'm just waiting, just nervous. And I didn't think she was going to show up. And lo and behold, here she comes. I'm like, Mom, I'm gone. And Mom's just sleepily just saying, okay, have fun. And, you know, on the way to her house, Sister Hinchcliffe was my seminary teacher. I was just nervous. But looking back, I knew that she talked with Sister Hinchcliffe about me, and she was just letting her know, and I felt grateful because Sister Hinchcliffe actually, like, she did her best to teach me, because it was that year's church history, Doctrine and Covenants. So I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. And I came in, and everyone was like in their PJs. They were my age, you know, and I was just baffled that this is seminary.
So what were you expecting?
I was expecting to go out in the woods in the middle of nowhere, really.
For seminary.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't like that at all. And Sister Hinchcliffe was super nice, and she modified the lessons for me, and it was a wonderful experience. Aww. That's something that I can honestly say, is that my experiences learning, like, my first few years have been probably the most life-saving, greatest experience I've ever had.
The kindness shown by her.
And everyone else, yes.
The seminary classmates, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I met probably one of my closest friends in seminary. To this day, we don't talk as much, but, you know, he's back east, and we're back, you know, I'm here.
In Salt Lake, yeah.
Uh-huh. But he's like my brother, and I met him in seminary. And from then on, you know, just learning about seminary, and then they invited me to take the lessons from the missionaries, and it was the plan of salvation that got me hooked.
It's beautiful to hear about that for the first time, isn't it?
Yeah, because that was something that I was looking for.
Yeah, that plan of salvation, it's a pretty amazing idea. Yeah, it's a concept that is fun to teach when you believe.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was honestly what wanted me to be baptized, because, you know, learning about eternal life and the premortal life, being able to see my grandparents again, knowing that I will be able to see them in heaven, it gave me a lot of hope. And yeah, it was like the fourth lesson in. And then about a year later, my mom finally let me get baptized.
Mm. So you'd been through the sequence of lessons.
Mm-hmm. Read the Book of Mormon at least 2 times.
What'd you think about that as you read it?
Looking back, I didn't really understand a ton of it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it I did hold dear to my heart. And there are a lot of good, nice passages in them. And I still keep those, like, sewed up in my heart in some way, shape, or form.
Is there a particular verse that still resonates with you?
Helaman 5:12.
Tell me about that.
That one, I believe I have the majority of it still memorized. Audience, please don't butcher me or cuss me out for...
Oh, we don't Book of Mormon shame around here.
And it reads, "And now, my son, remember that it is upon the rock of our Redeemer, who is Christ, the Son of God, that ye must lay your foundation, wherein if the... when Satan brings forth his mighty storms, yea, his shafts in the whirlwind, that you will have..." Basically, I can't remember the last part, but that's such a beautiful... that was a beautiful scripture. And, you know, I still hold it dear, even though right now in my current situation I'm agnostic. I've become agnostic. You know, it's still a beautiful piece of scripture.
So let's just dissect it just for a minute. What is Helaman asking us to do?
He's asking us to remember, you know, who we should build our foundation on.
And who is?
Jesus Christ.
Okay, and so Jesus Christ's words to the lawyer. Do you remember his words to the lawyer about how we get to heaven?
Oh, it's been a while.
So Jesus Christ tells the lawyer, you must love God and with all your might, mind, heart, and strength. Yeah. Love your neighbor
as thyself.
Love yourself.
Yeah, right? I remember that.
And then he says in the King James Version that we, that or at least I grew up on, and that you used as an active Mormon. Then he goes on to say, upon this hang all the law and the prophets. So Jesus is saying, start with love. Love of God, love of others, love of self.
Right.
And then everything else is secondary. So Helaman really at his core is admonishing. There's a Mormon word I'll throw in there. Helaman is admonishing us to remember the core message of Jesus Christ, which is love.
Right.
And maybe that's why that resonates so strongly with you.
You know, you saying that? Yeah. Because, you know, that's what my mom, that's what my mother taught. That's what my grandma teaches me even to this day. That's what my grandfather, God rest his soul, has taught me, you know, to love others and love God, you know, because he's the way, he's the truth, he's the way to happiness. But when we have genuine love for our fellow man, we can handle that with a positive attitude, and we can become further as a society, as a whole, you know.
I love that. And I agree with everything you just said. Yeah, 1,000,000%. So you got baptized. Yes. How did your family feel about that?
My mom was adamant at first.
Adamant about what?
Well, she's also heard about the Mormons. Mm-hmm. But she was more adamant that I was going into it too early. She wanted me to find out fully for myself, and she wanted to see that I was truly in it and I was dedicated, and know that if I go into it, I'm in it. My mom, she didn't really like push on us a certain or a specific religion. Yeah, we went to church. I think in essence my mom is just Christian. And if anything, whatever we chose to believe in, she would be okay with. Mm-hmm. And I really respected her for that, because it caused me to open like pathways and gateways that got me to get me to where I am today.
So she had some significant concerns, it sounds like.
Yeah. But
and you put them to rest.
I did. And the story doesn't end there, because after I went on my mission, the day I came home, when we were driving away from the airport going home for me to get released, my mom asked me to baptize her. I was just blown away, because I never thought that she would ever join the church. Apparently, she didn't tell anyone until she told me first.
Really?
Yeah.
I love your story. I really love your story.
It's an amazing story.
Yeah.
And stories like that are very beautiful. I can never, ever deny that, ever in my life. Mm-hmm. But for me, when it came to my faith transition, it made it painful, because it's like denying that actually happened.
Yeah, and we don't want to deny those things that happen that are so strong and so personal.
Exactly.
Yeah. How did you reconcile that? Or have you?
I believe I have reconciled it. You know, a lot can happen in 10 years.
That was 10 years ago you joined the church.
Mm-hmm. It's not that I've completely, like, because sometimes I feel that I just turned my back on something so beautiful and precious. But it's not that. It's me moving on and finding my own source of truth. And yeah, God's not in the picture in it for me right now. I don't claim myself atheist, but agnostic. And my feeling towards God is one of kind of anger. And I think that's the reason why. That's helped me bring comfort, give me comfort to know that that is something that I will never, ever forget or never, ever brush aside.
Tell me what agnosticism means to you. Let's define that just for a moment.
Agnosticism to me is a belief that there might be a God. Or this is how I was explained what it was. A belief that he is out there. Or he can be, or he's not there. And you can, like, mostly if people, what I understand, please correct me if I'm wrong. Those who have gotten who've navigated to that there is no God goes to atheism, and those who, for me, believe that there is a God, but he is not like divine, he's perfect, he is just, I don't know, I guess in Mormonism, a glorified man, then that doesn't really have any, that doesn't really have any power over you. You know, you're kind of agnostic that he's just there, but he's just there, you know?
One thing I've learned is that I can never define another person's belief for them. So if that's what agnosticism means for you, then that's what it is.
Thank you. And I think that's incredibly important. You know, I appreciate that. And I, if a person comes up to me and says, "Hey, you're wrong about agnosticism," you know, this is what I feel it is, and that's okay. I'm like, okay, that's how you see it. But this is how I see it for myself, you know.
So, an amazing journey, a conversion, very interesting conversion story, powerful spiritual experience with your mother.
Yes.
And then at some point, you decided to move and live back in St. George, which is where I met you.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
It was really rough. I came home to quite a lot of family issues, financial struggles and stuff like that. And I needed to navigate through that and trying to figure out what I'm going to do about my future. And one thing I knew for sure is that my time in Utah was beautiful, it was great. I loved Utah. St. George, walking down the streets of St. George was amazing. It was just so beautiful. And I wanted to live there. I wanted to make that my home. So I came home. 9 months later, I worked. I was back on the plane back to Utah. I saved up enough money to start off. I had $300 and three suitcases, and a friend was kind enough to actually buy my plane ticket back.
What a leap of faith.
I know, right? It's crazy because I was like, I actually established quite a few connections here in St. George. It's a wonderful family. Let me stay with them for about a month, so I can get started in school. I tried Dixie State, and then I got a job at the Iceberg Drive-In
Oh,
on
you
St.
got a
George
job at
Boulevard.
Iceberg.
Yeah.
I love that.
It was hard. It was really hard because, you know, I had just trying to start off. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to start off school and
Let's kind of rewind a little bit and let's talk about self-discovery. At what point, at what age, did you kind of discover this about yourself that you were gay?
I noticed when I was like 9 or 10 that I watched cartoons and I thought I really paid more attention to like the male characters and stuff like that, and I didn't think anything of it.
What cartoons specifically?
Japanese cartoons like animes and stuff like that. I thought, for instance, like I thought all you anime watchers, I thought like Sasuke or Naruto were really cute. Older people, there was Cowboy Bebop, the main character, I thought was pretty cute. It was pretty hot. But I tend to just put that on the back burner and stuff like that. And I noticed that like in high school I paid attention more to like the guys. But also like knew that the word, you know, homo, or you know, the I'd rather not say the word here. And how people jokingly joke that, you know, if you're gay, you're evil, or you know, you're like the outcast or anything like that. Basically, being gay is the stigma of evil or not wanting to be around that person. It was sad, so
Did that bury, or did that make you afraid to kind of ask questions or talk about it to people?
it made me afraid to actually just explore it. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want anything to do with that because
What did that represent had you kind of explored that? What would that have meant?
it would have probably given me a lot more anxiety and heartache than I already had at the time.
So it wasn't safe.
It was not. Mm-hmm. And like, I didn't know. I just didn't want to know. But I knew, like, as I got older, especially like when I was like 19, I knew that those feelings were starting to become a lot more prevalent.
And here you are at this point in your life, mm-hmm. trying to decide to go on a mission or not to go on a mission.
Yeah, actually, I didn't go on a mission because I had those feelings. Like, a lot of those feelings and that self-discovery of that I was gay came after my mission.
Okay.
But the feelings were there when I looked at, like, the other elders and stuff like that. But I just buried that. I made preaching the gospel my number one priority. I can honestly say that was actually really dangerous. It actually made me feel low. It made me feel like I wasn't a worthy missionary because, you know, I had these feelings, I had these thoughts in my head, and then the attitude towards the LGBTQ community, when it came to that, I just focused on the gospel. I just focused on teaching the people. I put everything in my mission.
Was there any inner conflict about what you may have been teaching people about the plan of salvation, about eternal marriage, and about how you felt about your own sexuality?
Yes, not about my own sexuality, really, but the family, mm-hmm. eternal marriage. That was kind of the catalyst of what made me that was one of the few catalysts that made me navigate outside of the church.
So you went on a mission, put aside kind of a latent discovery of your sexuality, came home, baptized your mother, saved up some money, moved back to St. George, re-engaged with civilian life, let's call it. How did you move forward then with your reconciling about who you were in all these different ways?
It was honestly the series, the family that I stayed with, that helped me reconcile with that. Because being gay in a Mormon community is taboo, but they told me that their son was bisexual, and they accepted him. And at first, I'm like, how can you? You know, I couldn't understand that. But when it came to me reconciling, they were an integral part of me actually admitting to myself that I was gay. The reconciliation would take a year or two.
Okay.
They helped me see that it was okay to be gay. They helped me see that I am not an infection, I am not a disease, that there are people who do love me for who I am. And at the time, and this was just 4 or 5 years ago, it's hard to believe how much the attitude towards the LGBTQ community and the church has just drastically changed, even though we have a long way to go. They were the outsiders. They didn't like their ward. They didn't like the bishop, who I thought was a great man. They didn't like the things that were being taught at Sunday school, so they stopped going. And me still being very active, couldn't understand why they would do that to themselves. But then I realized why. A part of it was because they think it was just wrong that they were teaching that there is conditional love, I believe. I never really asked them, like, what was being taught in the wards, because I went to
the student ward. Right. Yeah.
I knew that was probably one of the catalysts, and also their love for their son.
Their bisexual son.
Yeah.
So they had quite a nuanced view on Mormonism. Yes. In at least one way.
Mm-hmm. That nuance was very scary to me. Very scary.
Tell me about why that nuance would be scary.
Because I'm used to, you know, keeping the commandments, following the word of wisdom, like being, seeing, like keeping the commandments and seeing the blessings from that. And I just think them believing this way, not truly believing what the prophet says about it, is dangerous. And it's going to lead them to, it's going to lead them, I guess, to outer darkness, you know?
So you were coming straight out of this mission field experience where it's a very literal belief or a very literal non-belief.
Yes.
And you're running into people who have a pretty different take on Mormonism.
Yeah.
And that was scary to you.
It was scary. And it was just new because it was like, I was taught that it was just black and white. Granted, I learned this on my mission that it was just black and white. Follow the prophet.
Right.
Or follow Satan or follow the devil. And there was no in between. There was no gray. And I always wanted to go on the side of good. The side that always, that I was told would always win. This huge battle of good versus evil, and God will come down and blow his trump. And those who have followed him will receive everlasting life, and those who haven't will receive everlasting damnation. And I was scared for them. And I didn't want to see them. I didn't want to see them go to hell. But in my mind, that's how I felt. That was what was going to happen. I love this family.
Yet they're extending to you an unconditional love, an unconditional acceptance, a nuanced view of Mormonism that embraced and accepted you who you were before you kind of even really, it sounds like, knew who you were.
Right.
And that scared you.
Right.
That's how deep this internalized homophobia can be.
And it was really deep. Like, going to how I came, I could even just say that I was gay. During that time, I was going through some major depression, some anxiety. One time I didn't even eat for 3 days. Just stayed in my bed and worked. And I went to sleep, and I slept for like 13 hours straight one day.
And that was out of fear about your own sexuality.
Exactly.
What changed? What shifted?
Well, I needed someone to talk to that I could trust, and I went to them. And they went back to the subject of gay marriage and LGBTQ issues. And then I just started bawling because I just told them that I'm gay. I have these feelings towards men, and I feel bad about it because I'm not supposed to. And Betty just looked at me and said, "We know." I'm like, "What? We know. We could tell. We have this sixth sense that we knew that you were, but we didn't want to push that on you. We wanted you to come to us first because that is the best thing for you to do."
These are incredible people.
They are. I was so sad when they moved. They moved to the Midwest of all places, Tornado Alley. And then I stayed with them, I think, all night. And they talked with me. They stayed up with me. And they told me to, if you want, go to your bishop. You know, do what's best for you, basically. So I did. I went to my bishop. And I told him. And this bishop was actually really amazing. And in fact, I didn't know it at the time, but he was a very humble man. He's a painter, a very famous painter in the LDS community, because you would see his paintings of the St. George Temple and the temple itself.
What's his name? Do you want to share it?
His name was, probably a lot of people will probably know him from his work, so I guess it's okay if I share it. It's Roland Lee.
Okay.
And he was just an amazing man. He was great.
Fine art painter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Landscape. And it was like his paintings are amazing, beautiful. And though he said he didn't really understand it, he didn't give that attitude of like, you need to change this, this, and this. He just told me to just trust in the Lord do what's right, you know, just keep the commandments, and I believe everything will work out.
That's pretty good advice. Mm-hmm.
So I did, and it's been great. He was a really, he actually helped me in my coming to terms with it and being active, and I was actually quite active in my ward.
In St. George. Mm-hmm.
You look pretty righteous, so I'm not sure you're going to understand this simile, but most podcasts are like beer. You have to drink a lot to get that buzz. The Sunstone Magazine podcast, on the other hand, is like whiskey. Small glass, big buzz. That's because our podcast isn't about interviews, conversation, or witty banter. Rather, it presents audible quality recordings of Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. Do you want to hear what the best LDS minds have to say when they say it perfectly? Then this podcast is for you. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone, and then join us for a weekly shot of the best of Mormon thought and experience. And yes, you'll be able to drive home safely afterward and get a temper recommend if you want.
The first time I met you, we spoke and you had a very strong belief system. You were relatively fresh off of your mission, and I sensed a fervor in you that was rather charismatic. It was a magnetic, and I just instantly fell in love with you. And tell us about that version of Wendell as you look back at him. Describe that version of Wendell from your position today.
I look back, and what I see in myself back then was someone who just wanted to do the right thing. Not for himself, for everyone around him. I didn't want anything but to truly belong somewhere. I felt that, you know, God was there, and I'm still a good person, and I wanted to do good to other people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was, I just wanted to serve. But at the time, I felt that I needed to take care of me. And that scared me, because that made me feel like I was selfish. I recognized that I had a lot of hurt going on in me, a lot of confusion. When you met me, that was when the policy came.
Was it before or after?
It was about 2 weeks. Wait, about 4 months after.
4 months after, okay.
And I met Lisa about a month after the policy hit.
Lisa
Fry. Mm-hmm. And like, that's all I wanted. I didn't, like, I had no other ulterior motives. I didn't want to be like the spotlight of anything. I wanted to be in the behind the scenes helping people. And I felt that I could do that the most in the church. And I felt that I was failing the church, because I had these feelings towards my church leaders. And it was just a time where I was just confused.
What do you think the confusion stemmed from?
Why? Like, the confusion was, why would they do this to me?
And who would they be?
The apostles. The men that I testified of. The men that I sustained as prophets, seers, and revelators.
With that hand to the square.
Yeah. Every conference.
Every 6 months. That's right.
It felt like they made me out as a villain, because I'm going to infect my future kids. Like, I wanted a family. I wanted to have kids of my own, and I still do. But I wanted to have it with a person that I am fully and truly in love with. Because I will, like, I told myself, I will teach my children to love, to follow Christ, to help other people. And it shouldn't matter. It really shouldn't matter if your family is comprised of two moms or two dads, or or a mom or a dad who's transgender or non-binary. I mean, it's so, like, at the time, I never realized how complex it is. But it's just this black and white, and they attacked a lot of us, a lot of good people, and I couldn't understand why. The crappy thing about it was is that all of my friends were getting married. They expected me to just stay celibate all of my life. And yet I'm supposed to watch as my friends get married off? Granted, I'm happy for them, but I don't deserve this. I don't deserve a life of celibacy. And what really kicked it was they won't explain why. Like, why are you excluding my kids? Why are you excluding children who have absolutely nothing to do with my own decisions? What, you say you protect the family? To protect that family? How is that protecting that family? Like you're not doing anything but harming and damaging that child.
I hear a lot of passion in your voice. I hear some pain wrapped in there as well.
Oh, it caused me a lot of pain because I wasn't just thinking about me. It hurt. It hurt because I wasn't even trying to fight for gay marriage, really. I was in support of the brethren in every aspect. Mm-hmm. But when you attack a child, that's not right. That's not Christ-like at all. Mm-hmm. And that just goes to show that that was not of God. Or if it was of God, which was pronounced by President Nelson, then God's an asshole. And I don't want anything to do with that. I mean, it just baffles me because I think it was the second article of faith that said, we are punished for our own sins and not by Adam's transgression. And they said that doesn't apply, or that they're not being punished. And then I'm reiterating, yes, they are, because they're not getting the Holy Ghost. They're not being able to participate with their friends. They have to wait till they're 18. And they said, well, they're not being denied anything. Like, yes, they are. Not only, even when they're 18, they have to denounce their parents. They have to denounce their parents, move out of their house. Like, that further tears apart a family. I don't see where the love was in that. And I'm passionate about it because that was wrong. No matter how many people tell me how much President Nelson said it was out of love, which I know we'll get into that, that was wrong. And I'm sorry, I'm getting a little passionate there.
Well, but it speaks to your purity of intent. And I want to kind of go back and have you repeat that scripture. Was it Malachi?
Helaman 5:12,
thank you. What's the core message of Helaman 5:12?
It is upon the rock of our Redeemer, who is Christ, the Son of God, that we shall lay our foundation, upon which, when the devil shall send forth his mighty storms, yea, his shafts in the whirlwind, that if you build your foundation upon this rock, you shall not fall. It was Christ. That was what the foundation of the church, I thought, was. Christ in the scriptures never did that. He let all of the children come unto him. And then
Third Nephi is beautiful in that regard, isn't it?
Very much so.
Yeah.
And it just caused a lot of confusion because they said that, you know, they say it was out of love, but there's no love in that. And then the next general conference, there is a sister, I forgot her name, who was talking about the importance of baptism for children. I'm like, I was just enraged. I couldn't watch it.
So you heard that message and it didn't line up.
No, it more showed exclusion, because she was talking about baptism and how receiving the gift of the Holy Ghost was the most important thing anyone can do. And yet, I'm like thinking to myself, she should have said, except for children of same-sex couples.
Right. So you're kind of in this interesting place of really literal belief after your mission, really wanting to do the right things for the right reasons. Nothing's wrong with that. And then hearing messages that are confusing, damaging, not with love, the way you thought you might be hearing those messages possibly. How did this affect you and your belief, looking back at what you might have taught in your mission, what you may have heard from the missionaries, what you may have experienced in seminary that led to your conversion? How did these new pieces of information, how did that affect you and how you felt about the church and your decision to join?
Well, none of that really came into effect until afterwards. I didn't really start learning or understanding the actual belief or the doctrines of it until after my mission. Like, I felt that they didn't give you any kind of information outside of what was in Preach My Gospel, and the missionaries who taught me didn't really teach anything that was, you know, outside of Preach My Gospel.
So let's talk about things that you weren't taught that would have possibly mattered to you as a young black man. What was not taught to you?
Race in the priesthood. Polygamy. Of course, Adam God theory. Mm-hmm. But what really, besides the LGBTQ issues that really, really scared me, as to did they really teach that, was blacks in the priesthood. I remembered hearing, like, I forgot what they call them. It's a person who actually, who helps, like, with the lessons. She said that...
The instructor?
No, it was in her house.
Oh, okay.
To teach an investigator.
Oh, okay. Member missionary,
yeah. She said, one day, Elder Hare, your skin's going to be just as white as God's is, because that's what they said. That's what, you know, I'm like, and I told her, no, that's not true. I don't think my skin's going to be white. I was born black. It's like, well, yeah, but, you know, the curse will be lifted and you'll be just as white as Heavenly Father. And my companion just looked at me, and I just looked at my companion, and when we were out in the car, I asked him, I was like, what the heck was she talking about? And he looked at me, and this was the scary part. I have no idea.
Oh, wow.
I'm like...
And you're hearing this from a member missionary on your mission. This is new information for you.
Yeah, I'm like...
And your companion. It sounds like it was new information for him as well.
Yeah, like...
How confusing was that?
I didn't know what she was talking about. Like... Was that something that were we supposed to teach that? Because that was something that wasn't in Preach My Gospel, of course. And of course, I can see why.
How offended were you when she said that to you in the moment? How offensive was that for you?
Oh, it was very offensive. I was like, "Excuse you? I think I have the patience of a Buddhist monk because I just didn't say anything.
I know that's true.
I just internalized it, and then." That didn't come up on my... That was my first area. That was, like, weeks before... Like, week... Like, two... Like, 5 weeks after I came out of the MTC. Down there, one of my... Because I think Hurricane West was their zone leader area. They were teaching a woman who was African-American. Like, she was ready to go. She was ready to be baptized. And then I think it was her... The member missionaries showed her a book from David O. McKay called The Church and the Negro. And it just cut her off. And they were asking me to come with so I can explain to her what, like, our stance on, you know, African Americans in the church. And here I am. I don't know anything about the past history. So here I am. I'm like, you know, just talking to her, and she was just quoting, like, Brigham Young, Joseph Fielding Smith, George Albert Smith, how Cain slew Abel, and that's why, you know, God cursed him with a skin of blackness, and that's why there's the African race.
Is this the first time you're hearing this?
Yes.
You didn't hear any of this taught to you as a child in your church?
No.
You're hearing it taught for the first time within the context of Mormon belief while you're serving your mission.
From an investigator who was black, who found this out on her own.
My heart is literally breaking for you right now.
I was just blown away because I didn't know what she was talking about. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know. All I know is that we don't teach that now. That's what I was told. At the time, I just brushed it off. I said to myself that I know that this church is true, that was just in the past. And then I found out that was only, at the time, 30 years ago.
Right.
And I'm like, when the priesthood ban was lifted, and I was, at the time, I was really mad about it, but I didn't let that deter from why I was there, and that was to serve.
And here's Elder Hare with this remarkable experience of conversion and baptism, serving his mission, doing all the right things, throwing a curveball. Where did it feel like that curveball hit you on your body?
My heart. Because I testify that Thomas S. Monson was a prophet of God. And in consequence, I testified that Brigham Young was a prophet of God. And he taught that I was cursed. I testified that Joseph Fielding Smith was a prophet of God. And he said that the curse of Cain shall not be lifted. Or I believe it was David O. McKay that said that the curse of Cain shall not be lifted in my lifetime or ever after. I testified to the divinity of an apostle who was incredibly racist, i.e. Marky Peterson, who said some incredibly horrible things about not just me, but my ancestors, my family. And he has absolutely no idea how we are or how wonderful not just the culture of, you know, African culture is, but how wonderful people, like just African American people are. And I testified that he was a prophet of God. And looking back, I'm like, did I just testify that I was below these men? And a part of me said, yes, I did. But I didn't do it on purpose. I did it because I felt that the church and these men were prophets of God.
I just want to hold some space for that. This incredible, kind of this inner betrayal that you... Now, I don't want to project, because I'm feeling some pretty strong feelings right now, and I'm trained not to do this.
Right.
But I'm doing it anyway. I'm feeling very protective of Elder Hare and the betrayal that you... Again, I my job is not to put words in your mouth, but I can't apologize for anybody else. I can't atone for their sins. But oh man, I ache for Elder Hare in that moment that was hearing that messaging, whom you most certainly didn't have any answers to any of those questions.
And I still don't to this day. The only answer I can honestly say is that they were just racist and that they taught their racism as divine revelation from God. Now, you know, I've never, like you said, you can't apologize for anyone, and I understand that. And you know, the wonderful thing, I guess, when it comes back to forgiveness is that, you know, there's so many people out there who don't harbor those beliefs at all. And that there's some there are a lot of people out there, especially here in Utah, who are ignorantly racist because that's what they were taught. But I don't think they know any better because, you know, living out here, I've heard some really, really racist things. The wonderful thing about that is that that's not being brushed under the carpet. The racism, I believe, that was taught is a necessary growing tool for the church, because that can never happen again, especially with the next generation. You're not gonna see someone yelled at or say stuff like that and say it was a divine revelation, knowing full well that it's not. A lot of what they said wasn't true, and people will interact with those of African descent and they will know for themselves that it's not.
You're holding the church with so much grace and compassion right now.
What can you do? I mean, there's little grace and compassion that I hold, but I will hold it where it is due. The one thing that I wish the church would do is apologize for what they did, for what they did say. And I don't think they ever will. Hopefully they will someday.
So there was recently a large celebration in the conference center about the anniversary of the lifting of the priesthood ban.
The B1 celebration?
Mm-hmm. Tell me how you felt about that.
I mean, I heard it was a very beautiful celebration, but we still have a lot of work to do. There's absolutely nothing to celebrate. And the very fact that was just 40 years ago, and where are we at now when it comes to African Americans in the church, or Africans in general? The very first African American in church history, period, was just called last conference. What is that?
You mean apostle, general authority?
Yeah, he was called to the office of the 70. Mm-hmm. The first African American. Now, granted, there was two Africans who were called to the 70 several years ago, but in a sea of white, there's only three.
In a sea of white, there's only three.
In the last conference, when I believe it was Elder Hales and Elder Scott, and I think Elder, you know, when all like the four apostles that all died, mm-hmm. I was hoping for an African American apostle, and it was like, one of my friends commented, I said, no African-American apostle. I was like, oh, don't worry, it'll come one day. And I'm like, no, it won't.
Are you tired of waiting?
I am. But honestly, like for me and my mind, my heart, it shouldn't really matter, because the Lord will call whom he calls if I still believed in that.
Which is an interesting distinction. Do you still believe that?
No. As of now, I believe that the Lord will call whatever white, cis male man,
straight
from Utah, that he wants. But I'm also very biased when it comes to that. I'm not going to admit a lot of, like, there's a lot of bias I can tell in my voice.
Well, and rightly so, I would say.
Yeah.
I think you've earned that bias. I would never second guess that. Tell me what lands on you with more weight, the LGBTQ issues or race issues?
The LGBTQ issues.
Tell me about that.
The only reason why it hits me so hard, that hits me so hard, is because I'm living in it.
More so than the black
yes.
space. Okay.
Yes. I mean, the uplifting of the priesthood ban is important to me. That was 40 years ago. I wasn't even born then. And even to this day, we are still recovering from the centuries of racism.
400 years of slavery.
Yes. And that's just a part of me. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to now, like, how would you feel knowing, for instance, that there's a man who's trying to pass a law that allows a business to fire someone just because of their orientation?
How would I feel about that?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you how I feel about that. As a queer transgender woman, it hits me as incredibly hateful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, issues like that, those are the issues that affect me.
Because they're in the milieu, they're in the current atmosphere in Mormonism. Okay, I can see, okay.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, because both of those things fundamentally speak to parts of who you are.
Right.
But the race ban isn't a current situation that you live within.
Right.
But LGBTQ issues are a current issue that you live within.
Right.
Okay, so that's where the distinction is for you. Okay, thank you.
And... you know, it's hard because, you know, you're basically in the forefront of major changes, incredibly major changes when it comes to LGBTQ issues. Just 3 years, the policy of exclusion, and that's what that is, was just lifted.
And do you know that it actually really wasn't lifted?
Yes,
yeah, there's a controversy about that just a few people are starting to pay attention to right now.
And I actually didn't realize it until I listened to Radio Free Mormon and Bill Reel's podcast.
An incredible breakdown of that.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm like, it really wasn't. And they're trying to hide it. I had an incredible journey of just self-acceptance. Being able to realize that it's okay to feel anger and hatred towards something, especially towards the thing that has really hurt and effed you up. And then now here I am, navigated out of Mormonism. I basically did everything I could to do what's best for me. I submitted my papers about 6 months ago.
Your formal resignation?
Yes.
Okay.
I stopped allowing men to have power over me because that was what was hurting me too. I had 3 negative experiences with the next 3 bishops.
In that single adult ward?
Not just that one. So it all went down to after Bishop Lee was released, it was another bishop.
And was Bishop Lee a supportive bishop for you?
I felt he was, yeah.
Yeah.
That was when I fully accepted myself, and when he became bishop, that's when I posted on Facebook that I was gay, because I felt that was important, that I come out on Facebook.
It's a major thing. I mean, historians in 100 years may not understand how important that declaration on that platform is.
Yes, and...
but today, it's the way we communicate major events in our lives.
Yes, and that was... in all aspects, one of the most important events. And my bishop, I guess, found out, and he said, I'm not happy that you posted that on Facebook. That just defines who you are. And I'm like, I had to correct him. I'm like, no, I'm not defined. That does not define who I am, Bishop. That is a very important part of me that I feel that you want me to just sweep under the rug, but it's not. And I refuse to. And I didn't do it. I didn't do it for you. I didn't do it for the stake president at the time. I did it for me. I did it so my family can know something that back in the day I felt I was struggling with. So no, I didn't do it for you. I did it for me. I came out as gay because it is a very integral part of me, and it's not a bad thing. And I left it at that.
You were advocating for yourself.
Exactly.
You were stepping into your truth.
Yes.
You were wearing your authenticity boldly. You also set some remarkably strong boundaries.
For him, yeah. And then...
well, for yourself, that you aren't going to lay down. You're not going to capitulate. You're not going to apologize for who you are.
I never thought about it that way.
Oh yeah, this is strong boundary work.
Yeah, so I did feel really empowered.
Yeah.
Because it was something that I was denying and it was causing me pain. And then the policy happened.
Tell me how that policy landed on you.
Oh man. So it landed on me like a ton of bricks, honestly. I was looking for groups. So I found Affirmation Living Waters, and I also found Mormons Building Bridges. I was part of North Star too.
And these are all groups that are LDS based, mm-hmm. with an slant towards belief, active participation, sustaining the brethren, having an active testimony.
If you're in or you're out of the church, they'll love you no matter what. And mm-hmm. so is Affirmation Living Waters. North Star is more of the one where to, you know, navigate like being fully active, temple worthy. So I looked on my Facebook and I noticed that there were like 40 notifications, like 40 notifications everywhere. And I just looked at one and then I was just reading. I was like, wait, what's this about a policy? Like, and I just kept on reading I read the comments and there were like 37 comments and there was just, I could tell there's so much pain going on. And I didn't know what was going on really. And I honestly didn't believe it until Elder Christofferson verified that it indeed is true. And that
2 days later in that, yeah, that video. Uh-huh.
And then like how it hit, like how I navigated it was, this is wrong. But the other part of me was, this is what the brethren says. It's true. Then I'll do my best to follow it. But the part of me that was screaming, this is wrong, was a lot stronger than the other part of me. I mean, it was so it was so complex, and I was really struggling with it a lot.
Can you talk about that struggle? Does it go deeper than what you've shared?
Now I have to live a celibate life, and if the Lord, like, I can be strong and I can do it because the Lord will sustain me. And then the other part is like, I want to have a boyfriend. I want to have a relationship. I deserve that. And then what made it worse is that one of my good friends was getting married. And then I was just thinking to myself, how come I can't have that? Like, why can't I be with the person I love, even though he's a man? I guess that's what really caused it. And I stopped going to church. I went back about 4 weeks later. And then my bishop, after, like, they were talking about how we need to sustain our church leaders no matter what. Or that's what I got out of it. And I left. I just walked out. I was like, I'm done. I can't do this. I can't freaking do this. And then about an hour later, my bishop came to my house, told me, no matter what, you can disagree with it all you want, but marriage is between a man and a woman. And I just looked at him and I said, Bishop, I know. I'm not fighting for that. I have absolutely no problem with the church teaching that. My problem? Will you let me sit in your pew with the person that I am dating, even if it's a man? And he didn't say anything.
Did you say it like that?
I did.
Yeah. With that strength and that passion.
Yes.
Yeah. Good for you.
And he just looked on the down on the floor and he's like, well, I testify that the brethren know what they're doing. And as of now, I would like to formally release you from your calling as ward clerk. And I would like to take, I will need you to return your temple recommend. I had my recommend. And at the time, I wasn't even thinking. I'm like, fine, whatever.
You gave it to him.
I did. That was hard. And then I moved to Santa Clara. I guess you can say the ward was just not caring. If you can say that I was an outsider. No one really tried to extend an open, like an arm of welcome or anything like that. And then I think the high counselor was talking about how people who aren't married, or who aren't sealed in eternal marriages, will will be damned. And I'm like, okay, first off, you need to shut your mouth. Because my mom's not married. My mom had me out of wedlock, and here I am. And I don't think she's going to hell because she's a damn fine woman. And just as much of a saint as you are, especially after the judgmental comments that you made. But I was stopped by my bishop.
You're getting hit. You're getting beat up on every single aspect of who you are. Your family, your race, your sexuality, your future is being stolen from you.
And like, so I was just silenced. I'm like, are you serious? And then he said, no matter what situation, the Lord will make it work. And I'm like, how will he make it work? No one's answering that question.
We're going back to that plan of salvation that you initially really felt strongly about. That there was this arc that you could travel with your family. And now you're really in a place where you're seeing very clearly that there's no space for a single mom or a gay man. Mm-hmm. Or other queer people too.
It's weird because, you know, you try to explain your point of view. You try to explain, like, why, you know, like, I'm not being antagonistic. I wasn't being, like, I'm supporting gay marriage no matter what. I was just trying to go to a ward where I can worship. I guess I had to be some sort of way to do so.
Some sort of way. You had to conform. Again.
And I refused.
Let's fast forward to Russell Nelson's address at BYU. You're laughing. Tell me about why you're laughing.
I think I've become more of a skeptic than anything.
Skeptic regarding what specifically?
What anyone who claims to be the prophet of God or any kind of higher authority will say. I was looking at the ex-Mormon Reddit, and I was seeing a lot of these comments about the talk. So I decided to just check it out. And man, I don't think my blood boiled so bad as to what he said. He flat out, to me anyway, he flat out lied about the policy. He said he taught that the five truths, I believe. One of the truths is that, you know, we are sons and daughters of our Heavenly Father. Like, okay, well, I don't really believe in God, so I'm fine with that. He believed that. He basically told us that whether it be by my voice or by the voice of my servants, it is the same. And then he went on about the policy. And when he said to that audience where they will just believe it and not even question it, where he said that policy was made out of love and that they pondered and thought about the repercussions of it in fervent prayer. How they announced the policy, I was just cussing at my screen because, one, the policy was never announced. As everyone on here knows, it was leaked. By who? We have our guesses who, but that doesn't matter anymore. Secondly, he said that the policy, they put into account every repercussion, every factor into that policy. And then they received divine guidance and inspiration when President Monson claimed it as revelation. And I'm thinking to myself, so all of the people that not only have left the church, but all of the people who have killed themselves, all of the kids who have been negatively affected by this policy, all of the LGBTQ+ kids that have been negatively affected, a lot of them my friends, you saw the repercussions of that. Did you really? And it felt like he was brushing their memory under the rug, saying that it was out of love. And then he reiterated that doctrines don't change. No matter the civil constitution, or what changes civilly. And I'm like, okay, fine, go ahead. That's okay. But just realize that a crap ton of your members believe, like, are supportive of same sex, of gay marriage. And whatever you say, whatever you tell them, they're probably not going to believe you all the way. And they're going to be affirming to their kids. They're going to be like, things are changing. That catalyst that, like, despite all of the damage that has been done by it, when he did that, when that policy was reversed, that was the catalyst. I believe that was the catalyst to show that they don't know what they're talking about. And a lot of people will see that. Because when, like, 3 years ago, when you say that it is revelation and then you reversed it, I think it was Bill Reel who said, you're basically, like, Radio Free Mormon and Bill Reel said, you're basically throwing God under the bus. And that you're saving us from God. Because you said it was a revelation. Revelation doesn't change. And then he said that policy changes. And I'm like, well, you didn't say it was a policy. You said that was revelation. God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Revelation does not change. So what is it? Which is it? Is it a policy or is it revelation? And then I've had people tell me that, you know, there's no difference between the two. And then, okay, well, then maybe instead of saying something as like staunch or as set in stone as revelation, just say it's a policy and keep it like that.
What does this tell you about the nature of God?
It tells me that God is not perfect. That he is malleable.
I love that word.
That he is ever changing. He is ever changing over the tides of us, his children. And
that's not what we were taught the nature of God was.
Exactly. We were taught that everything that comes from God was good.
And never changing.
Exactly. And this was not good. This was incredibly evil. This was a painful, horrible thing that I guess supposedly God did.
So next weekend's General Conference. What do you think? Any ideas? What you might hear? Any thoughts about what you might experience?
Well, my experiences with the last several General Conferences, I know Mr. Oaks is gonna, I'm not gonna refer to them as president. I don't think they deserve that.
Fair.
But I think that Elder Oaks is gonna say something incredibly controversial, as in, like, saying that marriage is between man and woman and all that good stuff, you know, defending traditional marriage, of course. I think last year President Nelson actually said something that was incredibly controversial as to, like, telling people who have left that they need to come back, or else they will be, you know, time is running out for them, that they need to come back. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, wow, okay. I would be incredibly surprised and that they will say anything about this talk that President Nelson has said.
Do you think the church is afraid?
Oh, yeah. I believe they are, because they know that their methods, the way that they've taught, what they have taught, we're not going to accept that, because we have experience.
And information.
And information is what's destroying, what I feel is destroying it.
Tell me about the ship you're building.
My ship is the subtle art of not giving a f**k ship. I'm going to name it that.
Named after the book.
Yeah. I've had a lot of pain in my life. A lot of people have hurt me, and I feel that I've probably hurt a lot of people in my life. But without that pain, I will never truly know what actual happiness is.
Which is a very Mormon concept.
Yes. I think we try so hard to have the perfect happy life that we try to take away the fact that a lot of that came with a process. I wanted to come out here and build a life for myself. I started with nothing and I worked hard to become where I am at now. I am engaged to a wonderful man because I had to go through the pain of self-acceptance and wanting to be with someone even though it is a man. I came to the painful conclusion that my church wasn't all that I thought it was going to be, and I've moved on from it, and I've become happier for it, you know?
The quality of your life now is better.
Yes, much so.
Yeah. You're finding love. You're finding a path forward with hope, commitment, yes. Dreams, yes. Aspirations.
And those dreams are not built upon what other people want, but what I want.
You're building your own ship.
Exactly. And it's great.
So there is positivity that comes out of this quagmire that we've slogged through.
Yes.
I'm so proud of you. I am so proud of you. I am so glad I met you and I've seen this journey from afar and closer, but mostly from afar. You have made my life richer and I can't say thank you enough. You have taught me a lot about the nature of man. You've taught me a lot. You've taught me a lot.
Oh, it's been great meeting you, Kimberly. And I do cherish our friendship.
Yeah. We're going to be friends for a long time, I think.
Oh, yeah. I think until after you die.
Possibly.
Yeah, I think even after, even in the next life, you know?
Well, we are stardust.